The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Be seated, please. First case in our calendar is 99-788, State of Ohio versus Lewis Eppinger. Mr. Horn.
May it please the court, good morning, justices, counsel. My name is Michael Horn. I'm an assistant county prosecutor from Cuyahoga County, representing the appellant in this case. My co-counsel, Mrs. Reed Snow, will address the proposition of law concerning the sufficiency of the evidence and declaring the defendant a sexual predator. I will address the issue of the appointment of an expert, and I would ask the court if I could have 3 minutes for the bottom.
I watch your time there on the clock.
Thank you. In this case, the appellate court ruled that the defendant has an absolute right to the appointment of an expert witness for the purposes of a sexual predator hearing. They made no finding that there had to be any showing of a necessity. They did ignored the fact that the burden is on the defendant in that instance to show reasonable necessity. The court held that if an offender requests an expert, but that request is denied, then the trial court commits error.
Counsel, if there was a required showing of necessity, then should the state be required?
Then it is at the court's discretion. We feel that if there is a showing of necessity, which is not done in this case, but if there had been, then it's discretionary still within the court, and only should be reversed if there is a reviewing court finds that there is an abuse of discretion.
But did the court even give the attorney an opportunity to show necessity? I mean, why the statement made such that was it?
Well,
you can show necessity all you want. I don't believe in experts in the story.
The defendant's attorney filed a motion for psychological and psychiatric expert. In that motion, no necessity was shown. And the lower courts have held that you just can't make a blanket statement that assistance would be useful. You must develop assertions that the proposed assistance would be useful and that the defense is inadequate if that isn't granted. And on this particular case, they made a written motion for an expert without citing any necessity or making, no attempt was made by defense counsel in this case.
Do you think the judge would have granted one of any conditions?
No, but I would, based on her statement, perhaps not, but I don't think that's the issue.
But we don't have to get to that issue, do we? If we find that you failed to prove by clear and convincing evidence, that's the ball game, right? We don't have to send it back for anything, do we?
We are asking this court to hold, based on other decisions, that an expert does not have to give money.
But we don't have to get to the expert, though, do we? If we find you failed to prove by clear and convincing evidence that he was a sexual predator, there's no question about the expert. That he doesn't come into play, does he?
No.
So we just, I don't know why the court appeals want to send it back for a second bite at the apple for the prosecution. I don't understand that.
They wanted to give the defense the opportunity to appoint an expert.
They also wanted to give the prosecution the second chance to correct their error, too.
Well, they stated, as far as the sufficiency is concerned, that the trial court should have reviewed the appellate brief of the trial court and the transcript.
Right.
And that was the reason to send it back, so that could be done.
From what I can see, the trial court found that he was a sexual predator just on what the prosecution said. period. No record review, no nothing. Correct? What evidence did you offer except a few statements by the prosecuting attorney?
There is the fact that the trial judge, Ms. Noah, addressed this penalty claim. The trial judge considered his prior record of violence or two prior convictions.
All that the trial court, from what I can see, considered is that she remembered she had this case and that it was a bad case.
She referred to it as a heinous crime. That is correct.
And that's what she predicated her finding on.
But she also was aware of the two prior convictions of violence that the defendant had.
But it wasn't, nothing was offered, though, at the hearing to substantiate these allegations. Correct?
Well, the prosecutor made their arguments, and it's up to the trial judge then to take that into account.
Is that all the prosecutor has to do to prove by clear and convincing evidence? Is make a few statements and rest?
That's up to the trial judge. I mean, it's a discretionary thing.
But the statute states that sexual predator means a person, et cetera, is likely to engage in the future in one or more sexually oriented offenses. Now, wouldn't it be a better practice than to give uniformity throughout the state in these determinations of who is a sexual predator to have expert opinion?
In certain instances, yes, but it should be up to the discretion of the trial court.
But I think that it would be difficult, no matter what the record and no matter the fact that the judge holds a hearing or doesn't hold a hearing, to make that determination, for a judge to make that determination, is likely to engage in the future this type of behavior. That's almost something that appears and needs an expert opinion.
Well, the statute sets out the criteria that the trial court should use in making that determination. And in certain instances, yes, an expert might be helpful, not necessarily in all circumstances. But the defendant still, we feel, based on the case law, has to show some necessity for doing that. And in this particular case, we can't even say the court abused her discretion in doing that because no necessity was shown at all by the defendant in this particular case.
The statute does set out the criteria, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
And as I read your brief, is it fair to say that you think this trial court met the statutory criteria in this case?
Yes.
Then it would also be fair to say, would it not, that your general position is that all the prosecution has to do and all a trial court has to do is to review the prior record, listen to some statements from the prosecutor, and that's enough to satisfy the statute.
Yes.
Forgetting experts, forgetting anything else. That's just enough. And maybe you don't even have to hold a hearing.
Well, we certainly have to have a hearing.
Okay.
And also, the judge was the trial judge.
I understand that.
So there would be other factors that you could say.
Well, that isn't going to be so in every case, and we need to set the general criteria. But let's just stick to that for a minute. Your position is that it is solely enough to satisfy the statute to review the prior record where the judge is the judge in the underlying case and listen to whatever the prosecutor says and it's over. The statute's been met.
Well, again, the court took into consideration the prior record.
I'm not asking what the court did. I'm just asking, isn't that your position, that this satisfies the statutory criteria?
The criteria set forth by statute, and what we are saying is that in this particular case, the criteria was met.
Counselor, is it also fair to say that rehabilitation is at least allegedly one reason for incarceration?
Yes.
How do you ever present establishing, as you say, this establishes and meets the criteria, how do you ever present rehabilitation? What if he had attended the sex offender classes that are given in some institutions, and what if somebody would have said specifically, yeah, this is a one-time incident with his girlfriend, and therefore he's not likely to repeat that? There's no room for that in your hard and fast rule that all you have to do is look at the prior record, is there?
No, the court could take into consideration if the defendant, while he was incarcerated, did take these classes. And that's why part of the consideration can be the inmate's record. And there was no indication. I mean, there is a, the defense has the opportunity to present a case for itself in the sexual predator hearing, and no evidence was presented by the defense that this man did make any attempt to better himself or to rehabilitate.
Did he have that chance in this case?
He was in prison for quite a long time before.
Did he have that chance to present anything at this, quote, hearing, where she specifically said, oh, I remember the underlying case, this was a heinous crime, he's a sexual predator. Next case.
The defense at the hearing made no attempt to call any witnesses. So no attempt was made to call witnesses, therefore the court had nothing else to consider from the defense.
We're struggling with, again, trying to establish this for the entire state. We're seeing a number of these cases, and I think that's why you've been getting these other questions. Would you have objected? You obviously objected to the appointment of an expert. Would you have objected to the defendant, in fact, having the opportunity to present these other items?
We did not object to the motion for an appointment of an expert.
So then we could say that probably under these circumstances, an appointment of an expert in these cases is the proper thing to do?
If the defense shows a necessity, that's the crux.
Okay, I think that's what we're trying to get at. Tell me the necessity. What's a necessity? I need an expert witness. You need an expert witness, you need somebody to come in and talk about the real fundamental underlying issues of it. What is the necessity?
Well, that's the burden is on the defense in that instance.
What can the defense show to satisfy you as a prosecutor that it was a necessity?
That this would be helpful in some way, that the appointment of an expert would aid the court in this particular case.
And what do they have to show that it will be helpful in some way? Would aid the court in showing rehabilitation? Would that be enough?
That's a factor.
Okay, and you'd say then there should be an expert.
If that is shown. And then it's a case-by-case scenario, I feel. I don't think that's kind of our problem. That's what we're looking to this court to do, to say to the lower court, there has to be some necessity shown, and we just can't make a hard, fast rule or establish that the appointment of an expert is mandatory when there's no case law or a statute requiring that.
But that's our problem, too. That's our problem, too. You have differing standards in every individual case. I mean, it sort of sounds like vote recounting in Florida. Different standards in each county.
You're right, Justice Brown.
Mr. Horn, my name is Moyer. The defender, public defender, as you know, argues that if we're not going to give an absolute right to the sexual predator, alleged sexual predator in a case such as this, that we should at least set a standard of a minimal showing of necessity. What's your response to that?
Well, there's no case law or statute requiring that. They're asking you to do something that hasn't existed before. I mean, the case law states...
Well, does that bind us? I mean, we haven't been asked to do this before, I don't think.
Well, this court has never, and the Ohio Supreme Court has never expressly set forth specific conditions under which a court must constitutionally provide an expert witness to an indigent in a criminal case. And the 8th District, our district, has held in other cases that the request for the appointment of an expert is not mandated, all right, under 2950.09b1. And again, the standard is in all instances where an expert is requested in a criminal proceeding that some necessity be shown and not a minimal necessity. The appellee is trying to say that there's something unique about the sexual predator hearing which makes we should lower the standard, and we don't feel that there's any precedent.
Let me ask you about a dispute apparently between you and the public defender about what the facts were that before the trial court. You know, the public defender, page 3 of its brief, says that a number of the facts that you suggested were before the trial court really were not part of the record, such as the previous rape by this same victim. What's your response to that?
That was in the trial transcript. And It is not, what I did when I wrote this was used facts from the trial.
Not the hearing before the trial judge on the sexual predator. Is that a stretch, do you think, to do that, to put those in the facts? I mean, it says, I think your brief says the testimony at the trial, okay, was considered by the court in making the sexual predator finding. Is that, do we know that? Did she consult this? I thought she said she remembered having this defendant before her several years ago, but
She remembered the trial. It was a trial. She remembered it because of some of the acts that had taken place. And that's why I then made reference to facts that came out from the trial. The court, or the state in this instance, is asking that an expert be given when necessity is shown, and only in those instances. And then it's up to the trial court to decide whether or not it's necessary to appoint the expert.
Ms. Snow is going to save her time for rebuttal because we've used your time. So, Ms. Snow, you can count on about a minute for rebuttal. Okay. Ms. Holman.
Chief Justice, Your Honor, opposing counsel, may it please the court. I'd like to begin with the sufficiency claim in this case. And really, I think what the Court of Appeals recognized in this case is that this was a perfunctory hearing, and one in which the trial court clearly stated on the record that she was not going to follow the guidelines that have been set out by the legislature, she was not going to apply the clear and convincing standard, and she was not going to look at the factors that the legislature said a trial court must look at.
And that's all in the record?
I'm basing that on the trial court's comments, likening expert testimony to gypsies, and also basically concluding that she doesn't really know what the legislature was intending. She needs to make this future recidivism determination, and this crime was heinous, so Mr. Eppinger is a sexual predator. This hearing is not what the legislature intended. The legislature put the burden of proof on the state to prove by clear and convincing evidence that an offender has committed a sexually oriented offense and is likely to commit future sexually oriented offenses, sometime in the future.
So it's your position you didn't have to present anything?
Correct, Your Honor. The legislature has placed the burden of proving that Mr. Eppinger should be labeled a sexual predator on the state. And furthermore, I think to pick up on a point that was raised earlier, I think in this case, the judge clearly shut down the defense from presenting any evidence and presenting the evidence that it wanted to present, which was the expert's testimony. Now, in this case, this hearing occurred 8.5 years after Mr. Eppinger's trial, conviction, and sentence. This is not the kind of case where the sexual predator hearing is coming immediately on the heels of the trial, where the trial testimony is clearly everybody's mind. The state stood up, presented an oral recitation of the facts, and then sat down and didn't really even argue that Mr. Eppinger should be found to be a sexual predator. And the facts that the Court of Appeals picked up on simply don't suggest that there's any kind of likelihood that Mr. Eppinger will commit another sexual offense in the future. This is his only sexual offense ever. The victim in this case was an adult. Defense occurred 10 years.
Let me stop you there. Let's see if we can resolve this dispute between you and the appellant about what was before the trial judge and this hearing. Do we know, did she look at the record and know that there had been an attempt or a rape apparently of the victim, which was not reported earlier, and that there was this gunpoint taking of her car and all that?
No, Your Honor. The facts were not before the judge. The sum total of the facts that were presented was based on the oral recitation presented by the prosecutor at the hearing. Then the judge stated she had, quote, recalled the case and that it was a, quote, heinous rape. But whether or not the judge recalled these additional facts is not in the record. And part of the reason that these things do need to be put in the record, and the judge does need to place on the record what factors she is considering considering is because the legislature has granted both the state and the defendant a right to an appeal. In order to have an effective appeal, there needs to be some kind of record.
The statute doesn't require that, though, does it? That seems to be an omission, or at least the General Assembly did not say that the trial court must go through, it says they have to go through these steps, but doesn't say that the trial court must indicate upon which of them it based its decision, does it? We would have
Your
to...
Honor, the legislature does not specifically state that. However, RC 2950.09b2 specifically states that the trial court shall consider, you know, factors A through H.
Right.
And for purposes of an appellate record, the court would need to lay that down. And this court has also stated in Cook that although the court does not need to go through each and every factor, it doesn't need to place its reasons for that finding on the record. And the judge gave no reason.
Your office handles a great number of these cases.
Correct.
Do you have any conception or feeling, or can you tell me the shortest amount of time you've seen from a conviction of the underlying crime until the sexual predator hearing?
In my personal experience, Your Honor, it's been maybe a week or two.
Okay. How do you find any one of those factors, and if rehabilitation is in fact a factor in incarceration, how can you show any of that within a week or two or a month?
Well, I would agree, Your Honor, particularly in a case such as this where Mr. Evinger is serving a 14.5 to 25-year sentence.
Okay, well, I didn't say I agreed with anything. I'm just asking questions. There's no way to show that, is there? Is there any way under the statute that you can have 5 years down the road an amended or an additional or a supplemental hearing? I don't see that in the statute.
No, I don't see that in the statute, I guess, that's part of the problem with the statute is that the legislature has required for an offender who's not in Mr. Evinger's position, who's currently being convicted, that the sexual predator hearing be held prior to sentencing. And obviously, if the offender is doing a substantial sentence, like Mr. Evinger, that predictive nature of whether he's likely to commit offenses in the future, after he served his prison term, trying to take into account variables such as whether he'll be receiving treatment.
So in fact, practically, there's no way to present any of those, some of those criteria, some of those sections in the statute can't possibly be met at a hearing by a convicted person under these circumstances who then almost immediately goes into a sexual predator hearing. And that brands him maybe properly, I don't want you to say you agree with me, or disagree. It brands that person for life without any chance of ever any rehabilitation, doesn't it?
Correct. And I think that is part of the reason that the legislature codified the fact that a defendant, you know, shall be given an opportunity to call an expert at these proceedings. And I would disagree with the appellant at this court that there's no legal or case basis to find for our position. The statute clearly says that the defendant shall be given an opportunity to call and examine and cross-examine an expert witness.
Ms. Holman, is the issue about who's to pay for the expert? In this case, the defendant wished to have the expert paid for by the state. And so the question, I sort of see the question coming down to whether or not that statutory language opportunity to call should be read. It seems the Court of Appeals may have read that as saying a right to be paid for in the case of an indigent defendant, the expert shall be appointed. Now, and it seems that your learned adversaries say this defendant didn't call anybody. It's the sound discretion of the trial court to decide whether or not it's reasonably necessary to call an expert. Is that your view, that it is a right And each defendant is, as a matter of course, entitled to expert testimony, that that statute requires that?
Correct, Your Honor. That is our position. The statute clearly says the shall have the opportunity. The defendant is indigent.
The shall opportunity. There's, you know,
correct.
Shall have an expert. No. Shall have an opportunity.
That's right. The statute does not say shall have an expert. The statute does say, however, shall have an opportunity to have an expert. And clearly, if the defendant is indigent, there obviously is no opportunity whatsoever unless there is a court-appointed expert. And I also think the legislature is in the business of writing statutes. It writes many statutes dealing with experts. The statute that the appellant is comparing to and asking this court to look at for correction simply contains different statutory language. For example, the appellant cites to, I think it's 29.024 dealing with experts in a death penalty mitigation thing. That statutory language is clearly different. That says that the trial court may, you know, if the defendant presents, you know, reasonably necessary reasons. There's no statutory language like that in this case. The legislature has mandated what it wants to occur in these cases. And I think also the structure of all of Chapter 2950 indicates that the legislature thought experts were crucial in these types of cases. Your Honor, I mainly handle cases on appeal. I have not personally handled them.
You've seen any on appeal where a prisoner or an expert was used?
No, I have not, Your Honor.
On appeals that I don't recall an expert being used either. Yet that seems to be a very large part of the statute with the presentation of expert witness. Are you aware of requests for experts being turned down in other cases?
Yes, Your Honor. There's a number of cases where requests for experts have been turned down on the basis that the defendant has not put forth some kind of reasonable necessity showing. And those cases have been upheld on appeal on this sort of faulty reasoning that other statutes in other contexts and other standards derived from those statutes should be applied in this case.
We see a lot of cases where a predator status is attacked based on one rape.
Correct.
Would the necessity alone be, if you have one rape, that certainly that factual predicate is not sufficient for a layperson to predict the future? Imagine if you have pedophiles and 6 or 7 kids in a row, you may not need an expert. But if you have one rape and you're finding that person branded for life as a predator based on that, wouldn't that seem to require an expert to look at all the social and psychological factors that compel that person?
Yes, exactly, and that's exactly what happened in Mr. Eppinger's case. I mean, although our position is if you ask for an expert, you should get one, in Mr. Eppinger's case, regardless of what the standard is, even if the court were to adopt the standard that the appellant has proposed, Mr. Eppinger could meet that standard. This is a one sexual offense case. The adult was the victim, the victim was an adult, and Mr. Eppinger is serving a lengthy sentence here, and this hearing is occurring 8.5 years after the conviction. I mean, if the state is going to go forward with simply that evidence, this does not suggest by clear and convincing evidence that he's likely to commit sexual offenses in the future. An expert would be crucial in this case to assist not only defense counsel, but the trial court in evaluating the factors that the legislature has set forth in this case and making determinations based on those factors and the ultimate determination that the trial court and both defense counsel and the state are not in a position to make or engage in because they're not psychologists and, you know, are unable to engage in those kinds of predictions and other things based on the legislature said that shall be considered in this case. And I'd also like to address the fact that even if this court were to adopt an abuse of discretion standard here, this judge clearly abused her discretion. Regardless of what defense counsel put forth, regardless of what reasons he was going to give, the trial court clearly shut that down by saying that an expert has no has no part in this hearing, and that she's not going to listen to anything that an expert would say in this case.
Well, that, I think the legal issue I see it as that's been presented is this issue, that whether the statute, whether it be 109B1 gives the defendant a right to an expert who's paid for by the state. The last sentence in B1 says the offender shall have the right to be represented by counsel, and if indigent, the right to have counsel appointed to represent the offender. What's missing there, it seems to me, is the right to have an expert witness appointed to represent the, or on behalf of the offender. The General Assembly obviously knows how to write statutes to give people clear rights to publicly funded experts. It didn't do that here. What's your response to that?
I guess I would disagree a little bit with the statement that they didn't do that here. I think they did do that here when they said shall have the opportunity. And again,
an opportunity to have somebody testify for you is certainly not a legal obligation for the state to pay for an expert, is it? If we adopt that as a rule here, I think that has consequences in other sections of the code, certainly, does it not?
I don't necessarily think it does. I think that the sexual predator statute is a body unto itself and is being dealt with differently, as this court has recognized, you know, in all of the cases that have been dealt with on the sexual predator issue. I would also note that the legislature did give the defendant an absolute right to counsel and court-appointed counsel. And think that the way to rectify that with the shall be given the opportunity is the fact that the legislature did not ever envision a hearing where the defendant would not be represented by court-appointed counsel. I think that the legislature, however, did envision a hearing where an expert might not be needed because counsel might feel that an expert was not needed and therefore did not request one. I think that the legislature did not want to set forth a statute that would somehow give parties the impression that an expert was needed in each and every case.
Well, you can always waive a right, can't you? That's pretty easy to draft, or you always waive a right. If you have a right to a court-appointed expert, you can waive that right, certainly. Doesn't mean you have to have a court-appointed expert, does it? Wouldn't mean that, would it?
Well, I think that if the defense has made a request for an expert, then the statute would provide that they would be entitled to one. I think that the legislature drafted this so that it's up to counsel as to handle the case properly and to be sort of, you know, in charge of the floodgates for these requests. If counsel feels that one is necessary to that case, then, you know, one should be given to him.
Supplemental authority, you cited us to the Steele case. So before you sit down, what nugget of knowledge do you want us to glean from the Steele case involving sexual predators?
Well, I think the Steele case is instructive, and I'll be brief because I know my time is out, is instructive in terms of how experts can be used when making these types of predictive determinations.
Okay. I wonder, because that's medically, and that's forcibly medicating involuntarily committed.
Correct. It was for that reason in the procedural due process aspect of that case.
Thank you, Ms. Holman. Ms. Snow, you may take a minute for rebuttal.
I'll speak quickly. Good morning. The court did not say that she was ignoring the statute, nor did that she was ignoring the legislature. The court did not shut down the defendant from presenting any witnesses. And if you compare the hearing here to the hearing that this court considered in Cook, you'll find that the PSI was referred to in Cook, just as the transcript was referred to at this hearing. The PSI was not made in the...
I'm interested in the court's comment.
It was a flip comment that was made, and it really isn't relevant to how the court looked at making the determination. The court clearly, on page 89, made a determination based on the evidence that was presented before her. And again, if you compare it to the hearing that...
what was the evidence that was actually presented to her?
The evidence that was presented to her within the record that was made is the trial testimony of the victim, which is the equivalent of a victim impact statement, the trial testimony of the medical expert, which again is the equivalent of what might be found in a PSI, the information that the victim...
Was that presented in detail or was that summarized?
It was presented a summary, but it was also presented so that the court could consider the fact that the victim had been raped over three times, that the medical expert testified that it had been...
I read in your statement of facts 3 to 50 times.
That's correct.
That's
correct, and that was in what Mr. Glickman stated at the hearing. So the court had that before her. The court also had the medical testimony that it had been a brutal rape, which had forced the medical difficulty in a medical removal of a tampon from the defendant. And also the court had before her the prior violent offenses. Not, they may not have been sexual offenses, but they have been violent offenses against other people. And these are all things that the court considered. The record reflects that the judge addressed the future conduct of the defendant on pages 8 and 9, and she said that while one can't predict and ruin the concept of gypsies, what was going to take place based on what was before her, which was the heinous rape, the violence over a period of time against this particular defendant and the victim, and the defendant's prior violent history. And based on that, she came to the conclusion that the defendant was more than likely to reoffend. Now, just as in Cook, the PSI wasn't attached to the record. The trial transcript wasn't attached to this record, but it didn't prevent the defense counsel from raising that. And just as this court considered in Cook, that the defense counsel never requested to present additional evidence or to cross-examine a witness, defense counsel had full ability to challenge any aspect. None of the aspects that this court clearly did not look at the trial transcript before she rendered the decision. No, she didn't. But just as we all have certain things that trigger memories in our mind, as Mr. Glickman started talking about the medical testimony and the tampon that was embedded in the victim, the court had a clear recollection, and she talked about how she remembered the testimony of the medical personnel and the brutal rape that occurred.
I thought I had read that she said, didn't I maybe try this case?
Yes, she did. And then
that doesn't strike me as a great recollection of...
But she goes on... Excuse me, Ron. She goes on to say that she does remember the medical testimony. It is in the record before you.
Let me just stop you there. You made a statement that I think is inconsistent with what your co-counsel said earlier. When I was asking about what facts were before the trial court in this hearing, not the trial,
right.
The brief says the testimony at trial was considered by the court in making the sexual predator mm-hmm. finding. I think you disagree with Justice Stratton that indeed the trial judge did not review the trial transcript. Did I misunderstand that?
She didn't review the trial transcript, but the prosecutor relayed the testimony that was given in the trial transcript. So that at least the testimony that he relayed was before her. And I do want to judge
what if his recollection after 8.5 years is different than the actual transcript. I mean, that's not really evidence. That's just a statement of one person's memory.
Well, Mr. Glickman wasn't at the trial. He was reciting from the transcript. It may not have been included. It may not have been before the court. But when he went to present the hearing, he reviewed these materials before he presented it. It wasn't from his recollection. Mr. Horn tried the case. I do want to touch on one.
Let me just say something here. I think just you appear in our court fairly often. At least your office does. You might want to be a little careful about making representations that suggest, at least by implication, that the trial judge actually reviewed the record. It's not clear from your statement of facts that this was just a statement made in the hearing. So there was a summary of the trial transcript. I think you want to be a little careful about that. Just okay.
The state concedes that's the problem. I want to refer to a question that was asked of opposing counsel as to whether or not expert witnesses ever testify at these hearings. Our court routinely grants requests, not in this particular instance, and we need to remember that this hearing was held in May of 1997. The use and the application of the statute has evolved over these past years, and our trial courts consistently grant request for expert witnesses as long as the defendant makes a reasonable, a case for reasonable necessity.
You've used your time, Ms. Snow.
Okay.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.